Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of July. Monday at 9 is All Things Political, and we have so much to talk about today. Judge Sotomayor begins her confirmation hearings this week, and we do want to tell you that they begin today, actually. Hearings are expected to last Monday through Thursday, and we are going to have a one-hour wrap-up of the day's events each evening at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. It will be in place of the first hour of On Point, and also there will be coverage of the hearings on Talk of the Nation, so you can listen to all of that starting today on the Ideas Network. Healthcare reform, where does it stand? An overhaul of the healthcare system? Do we need a second stimulus? How is the first stimulus working? The president suggests it will take a bit of time for this to work and that we need to be patient. Can we be patient? His trip to Europe and to Ghana, which he received as a superhero welcome, and we'll be talking about, well, one of our guests is from Alaska, so how can you talk with somebody from Alaska without talking about Sarah Palin, which of course we'll do. We'll be welcoming your phone calls for both our guests during this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Clive Thomas is joining us, professor of political science at the University of Alaska Southeast. Professor Thomas, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And also joining us is Professor Abdur Chowdhury, who's a professor of economics at Marquette University. Professor Chowdhury, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on your program.
Yeah,
thank you.
Our pleasure. Well, we have so much on the table. Let's start with the president's trip, if you don't mind, and specifically with Ghana, where it looked like he was running for election in Ghana. What a turnout, wasn't it? He was regarded a superhero in that country, and it was a moving appearance. As his trip to a death camp was, here he was in Ghana at the place where slaves were sent to the United States. It was moving, wasn't it?
Yes, I think very much so. I think that in many ways, the president, Barack Obama, is quite a character. And one of the things that you asked me on the program, I guess, to talk partly about Sarah Palin, and so I think that the two of them are quite contrasting in many ways, but I guess we could get to that later.
Yes, they are quite contrasting. What did you think of his latest journey, Professor Chowdhury?
I think he did have a clear message for the African continent. Basically, there are two sides of the equation here. On one side, the issue is that whether the developed nations have fulfilled their promise of coming up with, you know, a specific amount of aid for the African continent. On the other hand, whether the African continent has, you know, the countries in Africa, whether they have undergone the type of institutional change that they need in order to utilize the money that is going into the continent. So, you know, I think he had a good message on both sides of that equation.
Considering all that's on the table in the United States, health care reform, the stimulus, which isn't going as well as the administration would like, is he spending, do you think, as he's been criticized for, too much time on an international stage?
Well, I wouldn't, this is Clive Thomas here, I wouldn't think so. I think that there's a sort of an international deficit, you might say, or there was left over from the Bush administration in terms of American relations, and it seemed to be fairly international in many ways, maybe not with Britain and Tony Blair, but certainly with the rest of the world, and I think that this is part of what the president's trying to do. I do think, however, related partly to the first part of your question, that the expectations are so great that the gap between what can be achieved and what people are expecting, I think, may come back to be a problem for the president and his administration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I can add something, what I think President Obama is trying to do here is restore some of the credibility that U.S. had lost in the last 8 years in the international arena. And I think that's where his focus is right now.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Thomas, you say expectations are great. In what areas are they most important, and are the expectations greatest for the American people?
Well, I guess everyone has different expectations in different ways, I guess. But I guess mainly financial, the economy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not that necessarily the president could do much about it, but I think there's always expectations about that. Ever since Franklin Roosevelt was president in the 1930s, people expect somehow the president to be the chief sort of guardian promoter of the economy, I guess. But I think other areas, too. I think there's the healthcare issue, which, of course, seems to be bogging down.
Yes.
And I think, generally speaking, I think just the reaction to the last 8 years, I think, which, you know, internationally, at home and so on, just, I think, got people depressed, and I think, you know, in many ways alienated the United States. I do a lot of research in Latin America, and I've traveled there many times, and it's amazing to go down there the last 6 months and the sort of, I would call it euphoria, the positiveness that people feel. And there are expectations again, I think, whereas when I was down there 2 years ago, it was very, there's much more strong anti-Americanism than there is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be true wherever this president goes in the world. He is a president of the world in some ways, wouldn't you say?
Well, he's so charismatic. I mean,
yes.
Whether you support him, whether you voted for him or not, or anybody voted for him, you know, he's, you know, I've been around politics and teaching it for a long time, longer than I like to divulge on the radio. But I really probably have had to put on one hand five people who are so charismatic and so you know, widely respected, even if not necessarily somebody would support him politically. I think that he's one of those people.
Who are the others?
Well, I didn't know him very well because I was younger, but obviously charismatically Martin Luther King, I guess. I wouldn't put John Kennedy in that category because I think John Kennedy was much more hype than he was actually substance. I would say that Bill Clinton in his own way, I think, and Ronald Reagan definitely. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, obviously I would figure that Barack Obama has many IQ points on Ronald Reagan, but Ronald Reagan was very... You had to listen to Ronald Reagan when he spoke.
Mm-hmm. He was charming, wasn't he?
He was charming, and he was very skillful at not taking responsibility for some of the things that went wrong in his administration.
Right.
But not quite like Sarah Palin, but that's something we'll get to in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the stimulus for a moment. I have taken a different way to work. I like to drive different roads, and for the last few days I've been driving through a part of the central city of Milwaukee, which used to have a lot of small businesses, glass repair shops and little restaurants, etc. And I've been so struck on my drives the last few days that almost all of the buildings are just boarded up. These small businesses that provided a livelihood for people in our central city just can't seem to make it right now. I know that's a small indication of what may be going on, but it's a striking indication to me in our city. And I wonder about this stimulus, if the money is going to take a while to trickle down to give people jobs, if we need a second FDR kind of stimulus, a second go around here. Can you assess this for us, so starting with you, Professor Chatterjee?
Sure. The stimulus package, I would say it's still too early to have to say whether it's working or not. We still need to give it some more time. See where the money has gone until now. About $60 to $65 billion has gone out until now. Most of the benefits from the stimulus plan have gone to the state and local governments to pay for Medicaid, to pay for educational programs, and expanded unemployment insurance benefits. In terms of infrastructure, I would say that not that much money has gone out, but just to be fair, we should also remember that for infrastructure projects, there's a lengthy contracting process. So even though a project may be what we call shovel-ready, still it takes a little bit of a time for it to start kicking in. Now, for the stimulus package, I think the impact that we will see would be mostly in the second and third quarter of this year. So in the first quarter, we did see some impact. For example, if you look at the unemployment rate, the job loss, we do see some decrease in job loss. In the first quarter, the job loss figure was about, on average, 650,000 per month. It has come down to about 500,000 per month, and it's going to decrease, although the unemployment rate will continue to increase to, I would say, about 10.5% by early next year. So I think it will take a little bit more time for the stimulus package to kick in, really. About this, whether we need a second stimulus package, I think it's too early to say that we need one. First, we have to see how the first one works out, and then if it doesn't, then we can look at the second stimulus package. But I think at this point, talking about a second package would be too early.
What do you think, Professor Thomas?
Yeah, I tend to agree about that. I think, you know, I mean, I've tried to follow this as closely as I can, and you know, I don't see much of the effect of it in Alaska as much, but you know, that's very local, very I guess peripheral in many ways. But I agree with Professor that we probably need a little bit of time to watch this work its way through. But you know, I think there's no sort of, you know, silver bullet for this. I think the administration is trying their best. I mean, I don't think anybody knows exactly what to do. Everybody got hit by this in a major way last summer. Late last summer, and I guess there's a lot of flailing around, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the suggestions from some economists that this was really falling short, and we do need, I don't know, we go more in debt or how we pay for it, but we really need a huge stimulus to really lower that unemployment rate and put a lot more money back into the economy. We've fallen way short here.
Can I say something facetious?
You sure can.
You get 12 economists, you get 13 perspectives. That's what I learned in college.
What do you think, Professor Cheddar?
Basically, I think this $787 billion stimulus package, I think it's right. You know, obviously, you can come up with more money, but there is a political view in Washington that you have to recognize that, you know, we do have $787. There was a lot of criticism that this was too much. So I think, in terms of amount, it's quite right.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little bit of time. We're going to go to phone calls shortly, but on Sarah Palin, who once again is in the news front and center, and I wonder if she still will be once she does whatever it is she's going to do next. She has received an incredible amount of attention. Some are saying, now we keep talking about whether or not she's running in 2012. Is this a play for the presidency, and she's going to spend time on it? What in the world is she doing, Professor Thomas?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, quite frankly. I've followed Sarah Palin ever since she hit the scene here in 2002. She ran for the lieutenant governor's position, and I teach state politics here. I've done a fair bit of writing on Alaska. I do a lot of teaching in that area and so on. I've done some a lot of research on Alaska politics generally. I run a program in a legislature for interns. So, but I have no... I really don't know. I think that she is, in many ways, one of the most enigmatic people that I have ever come across. And once again, while Barack Obama is a phenomenon himself, I think that she is in herself in many ways. And there's very divided opinion about her, as you know. There are people that think that she is very positive. There are people that are very critical of her. So it's hard to know. I think that I read... an editorial in a London paper. I was in London a couple of weeks ago, and I think I would sum it up. They summed it up very well. There's a very fine line between being a maverick and being erratic.
Mm.
And I'm not going to come down on either side of that, but I think that may sum her up.
Mm-hmm. And do you think she is preparing for a run in 2012 right now, and she will just...
Well, there's a possibility. My feeling about it is that... personally, if you look at the numbers, you know, American politics is the politics of the middle, politically. Barack Obama ran from slightly left to center. He's pulled into the middle now, maybe even pulling a little bit to the right, not conservatively, but in many ways. And Sarah Palin's support is about maybe a narrow 10 or 12% of the American population. You can't even get the nomination for the Republican Party like that. And I would point out that many people in the Republican Party are very much critical and opposed to her. On the other hand, you know, she obviously strikes a chord in American politics, and she could probably have a 3 or 4 or 5 or maybe 10-year career going around doing talk shows, making a lot of money, and being a spokesperson for that segment of the Republican Party and of Americans who are anti-government, who do or are have certain values which, you know, they have absolute right to hold in America. That's what America's all about. But I think that running for president in 2012, given the state that the Republican Party is now in, you know, they've got to really start to put their act together for 2010, let alone 2012. And so I think she'd be a very divisive candidate for them, but that's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the party? What happened to the Republican Party?
Barack Obama and Dick Cheney, I think. That's what happened. maybe George Bush, but not quite the same. Donald Rumsfeld, I think, being in power. It happens to all parties. The British Labour Party has been in power for 10, 12 years now. It's parties that they get lazy, corrupt things develop. People, they get very power. They believe that they have a right to power and so on. You can see it in the history of the United States and the history of Britain. I think that's what happens, and we get this cycle. And by 2018, the Republicans will be back in power, and the Democrats will be on the defensive. And that's a good thing about American politics, a good thing about democracy.
Hmm. Professor Chatterjee, do you see any rising stars among the Republicans?
Among the Republican parties, I would say a number of governors look like the rising stars. And to be honest, I wouldn't put Sarah Palin in that group. Bobby Zindel or Tom Pawlenty from Minnesota, I think, would be in that group. I had initially Mark Sanford, but then I crossed his name recently.
I wonder why.
But there are a number of young governors who I think do have a future in the party.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. It's All Things Political. Please join our conversation right now if you'd like. We've just begun talking about whether or not we need a second stimulus, the president's latest trip, Sarah Palin, of course, because one of our guests follows and teaches Alaska politics and, as you heard him say, runs an internship program for his students in the Alaska legislature. So we're talking about her future and the future of the Republican Party. Healthcare reform, certainly something that has been stalled, as one of our guests has said. Do you think that we need to make sure that something happens to overhaul the system in the next few months? And is this the only time that it will happen? Does the president need to get more on the bandwagon here? Judge Sotomayor is starting her hearings today for the Supreme Court, and you'll be hearing updates on that here on the Ideas Network. So we'll talk about her nomination here. The president's trip, I was particularly struck by his trip to Ghana. He has these moments when he makes speeches, and they're important, aren't they? They address history and weave it into the present, and they're important, I think. And that was another one of his important speeches. What did you think of that? So join us. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email today, you can do that as well. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guests are Professor Clive Thomas, Professor of Political Science at the University of Alaska Southeast. He was educated at the London School of Economics and Political Science, University of London, and has taught at political science at the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus since 1980. Also joining us is Dr. Abdur Chatterjee. He's a professor of economics at Marquette University, and we're happy to have both of them here, and we'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to give you an update on our Springfield trip. A few weeks ago, we announced that we're going to Springfield to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. We're going to have a great party and learn so much. We had a huge response to this, so we've added a second bus, and here's the story on it. We have a few seats left, so for those of you who are hearing about this for the first time, because you were somewhere else, it's October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and we are going to be visiting all of the sites in Springfield. We'll go to Lincoln Museum, which is relatively new and very, very good, the library, the law office, his home. It's the only home he ever had in Springfield, his boyhood home in New Salem, and we'll be staying at the President Abraham Lincoln Hotel and Conference Center. We'll have a local scholar with us who will travel on the bus. And then we'll also have one of the nation's preeminent Lincoln historians from Knox College, who's the co-director of the Lincoln Studies Program there and author of Lincoln's Sword, The President and the Power of Words. And plus, we'll have all of the Wisconsin Public Radio listeners who are Lincoln lovers. Oh, it's going to be a good trip. So we just have a few seats left for the second bus. If you would call Lisa at this number, and we'll fill that up, and we'll be raring to go in October. Weather will be perfect. Great journey. 414-390-1073 is the number for you to call. You can get more information about the tickets and all of that. It's a pretty reasonable trip, actually. So it's 414-390-1073. All right, whoops. Put that down, and let's proceed to phone calls. Jim from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Fine, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I just want people to take a look at the long-term trend in American foreign policy, and I just cite a man that you can go to his website. He's written evidently for the Washington Post. His name is Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R. He may have been on public radio. He's written a book called Overthrow. Also on his website, he has a video that of a two-hour DVD of a presentation he did in the Chicago area, which I think would be interesting. And the theme that he's putting out is that really from Hawaii, the seizure of Hawaii all the way on up to the present, that we have a long track record of in American foreign policy of it being ostensibly committed to democracy on the one hand, but in practice supporting a repressive regime so that we can exploit people in the third world for their resources and their cheap labor. And I think people should really look at this because he also has good observations on Iran and how Iran potentially can be very favorable to the United States through their young people, but how our practices in the past towards that country have alienated many people and put us in a vulnerable position.
Professor Thomas, you want to start?
Yes, I'd be happy to respond to that. I guess in a nutshell, I think we've got to distinguish between the American government and the American people. I think America, generally speaking, is committed to democracy. But what happens, I guess, are a couple of things, is that you know, things happen in the world, and you're faced with a choice. Do you support a dictator, like someone like Augusto Pinochet in Chile in the 70s and 80s, or do you take the risk of there being some radical communist government or something? And I think Americans have made that decision, and American governments have made that decision, and certainly the record is not good, and I certainly agree with the caller in this regard. I think a lot of it is to do with American psychology. I lived in Europe for many years. I'm originally from England, obviously. I didn't move to the United States until I was 27. And we lived next to the Soviet Union, and people weren't concerned about communism in the sense that Americans are. I think, you know, in the 50s, there was the paranoia of the McCarthy era. And there's just something about the American psyche, which I guess is this fear of communism and fear of radicalism. But you get a lot more with honey than you do with vinegar. But I think when the choices come, that happens. So there's no doubt that there's been this trend. I don't see it as a conspiracy. I think that it's a sort of, it's an ad hoc thing. You know, governments respond at certain times, and they end up supporting dictators, and it looks bad for America, and it makes other countries feel bad about us, and the Iran situation may be part of it. And there's a clash of cultures and values, too, of course. So it's a complicated issue, I think. But I think that in the end, it boils down to sometimes supporting regimes that make America look like it's somewhat hypocritical. I would agree with you.
Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. Kyle is next from Sheboygan. Hi, Kyle. Kyle, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
My question was in regards to the economic stimulus package. I was wondering about concerns about paying back the money. How is that going to go about? Also, is there a worry about hyperinflation and a decrease of the American dollar?
Professor Chattery?
Yes. In terms of paying back the money, there is a long term to pay back, so that I don't see that to be a problem. Now, what I see the problem is what the caller rightly pointed out, to the possibility of having an inflation. The amount of money that has been pumped into the economy, both through the stimulus package and also by the Federal Reserve Bank, there is a possibility that maybe not in the next 6 to 9 months, but sometime in 2010 or 2011, inflation can increase. Now, so the important thing to see would be whether the Federal Reserve Bank can time it right. That means they need to continue with that expansionary policy so that the economy recovers, but they have to tighten the policy at the right time to make sure that inflation doesn't increase. So I think the Federal Reserve Bank has to play a significant role here, and they have to walk a fine line on this one. But inflation is a problem that I think the Fed has to be concerned about in the near future.
And thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Cynthia from Milwaukee next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about health care.
All right.
And I guess I have a comment and a question. I'm a nurse. I've worked in hospitals. I've worked in public health. And I'm currently a home case health care case manager in hospice. So I've seen the system across the spectrum. And it is terribly broken. We are fortunate to have in Milwaukee 16th Street Community Health Center, which I believe is a role model for the delivery of public health to underserved populations. And the community health care system in this country really can serve as a model for how to provide health care to a lot more people. Some of the things that I think, and I would ask speakers to comment on possibly, are that the healthcare system in the United States moved in the 20th century from being run by doctors to being run by corporations and multinational corporations, and it became a for-profit, even not-for-profit, became for-profit organization. The other thing is that healthcare has moved from, the big concerns in the early 20th century were things, like the flu epidemic, pandemics, and things, public health issues, and now it really is chronic disease and the elderly. So there's many shifts that it's taken, which I think contribute to why it is so complicated. And it's my belief, as I guess some people call a flaming liberal, that we really have to look at the pay scale for doctors. On your NPR, you've talked about how primary care doctors are paid much less than specialists, and we need more primary care doctors. Special care needs to be available to more people, and we need to look at the way that money is made in the healthcare system. And these things have all been talked about, but when you put it all together, it's just terribly complex. So I just wonder what the economists and political scientists...
Okay, and let me ask you before we go to them, Cynthia, do you have something that you think is absolutely needed in terms of healthcare reform in this country?
Yeah.
What would that be?
I think... well... I guess, to consider, I think that the power of help of insurance companies
mm-hmm.
and the power of hospital organizations who drive the prices and who keep the focus, and in some ways it's so complicated because people want to be able to have those extreme services when they're needed. So how do you shift to primary health care?
Right.
And keeping people healthy, that's a huge...
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot happening on that scene. So in a sense, it's like moving from the industrial age to the computer age or something, or agrarian society to... it's huge.
Right. Professor Thomas, you've had experience with two systems, so you may want to bring in your... British experience as well, but this is a huge issue. I'd like to spend a few minutes on it. What do you think of her thoughtful comments?
I think that her caller's summed it up in one word, and that is complicated.
But mm-hmm.
I think that, in a nutshell, once again, I'd like to look at it from an economic and from a philosophical point of view. I come from a system, the British system, which is reviled in the United States because people don't understand it. But basically, in Britain, everyone gets covered. So, whether you're a homeless person or you're the British equivalent of Bill Gates, you get covered.
Mm-hmm.
There are 49 million Americans that aren't covered, which, in a country which is fairly healthy, fairly wealthy, seems to be foolish. Plus, a sick person is not a productive person. And contrary to what a lot of people believe,
most of those people are not people who are on welfare or lazy. There, a lot of them are single mothers with kids. And so there's that perspective. The United States could help cover that. But it's a highly political issue. And the problem is middle-class people like me who have coverage are fearful of losing that and not being able to go to the doctor when they want to. They feel they have to wait 9 months for an operation. That's not what happens in Britain. If you have a wart on your neck, it may take 6 months to get it off. But if you have a heart attack, you're in hospital within 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, politically, it's a nightmare in the United States for that. I agree with the caller also why the Clinton plan failed in the 90s, partly because Hillary Clinton was put in charge of it and she was new in Washington, and that did not go down well with the Senate. But also because you have three very powerful interests, the pharmaceutical companies, the doctors, and the insurance companies, and probably the hospitals too, who were able to kill it. And, you know, I study interest groups and have for 40 years, and so I've studied that issue pretty well. But I guess my prediction on the healthcare thing would be we'll just bog down. I don't see anything happening politically. It's a very tough situation. And it's unfortunate, but I think it will bog down in politics.
Mm.
The economics of it are definitely important, but, you know, once again, I'll be a flaming liberal here. I could afford to pay another $150 a month in tax on my income to help, you know, to go into some pool to help somebody, but that's not the way that a lot of people think, and I understand that because that's the American way of thinking, but I personally see healthcare as the number one issue in America.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Cynthia, for the call. Professor Chatterjee, do you see that the reform proposals really getting bogged down, no action on healthcare this year?
In fact, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Professor Thomas on this one. I do think, I agree with him that, you know, and also with the caller, that it's unconscionable that, you know, in a country like the U.S., about 50 million people are without health insurance. Now, the health reform plan that President Obama has forwarded now to the Senate and the Congress, basically, I think there will be some horse trading going on, but I do think before the end of the year, we will see some positive steps here, and I do think we will have some sort of health reform. Obviously, we may not have the one that we want. There will be some negotiation, some give and take, but I do see something happening.
Okay. Do you see some kind of public option?
Yes, I do see. If you look at the centrist Democratic senators, there is a move, although very slow, towards some sort of public option. So I do see there will be some public option. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thanks very much for your call, Cynthia. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and this is All Things Political, always heard Mondays at 9. So move the conversation in any direction you'd like, be it the president's latest trip, Judge Sotomayor, we have yet to talk about her confirmation hearings, health care reform, the stimulus package. One of our guests is from the University of Alaska and teaches state politics in Alaska and has covered Sarah Palin and watched her for a long time. We can talk about her, all these issues on the table, and then some things that maybe I've overlooked that you want to bring up. June from Toronto is next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
I'd like to address this to a professor from Alaska who teaches there.
Mm-hmm.
My question is everyone in Alaska similar to Sarah Palin in their political views? I know sometimes in the lower 48 we have intrusive views about how Alaska should be run, particularly in terms of global warming, protection of animals, oil drilling, and things like that. Are there people there who might agree with that view, or are they all like Sarah Palin?
Is everybody like Sarah Palin in Alaska? Here's a question. Professor.
Let me say this, and your question is a very good question. There is probably no state in the Union, including Hawaii, that has more myths about it. I live in Juneau, where cruise ships come in. I'm often asked, what currency do you use here? You live in an igloo. You know. Alaska is like any other place in the United States, largely. People get up in the morning, they go to work, they have jobs, they get paychecks. The difference about Alaska from the lower 48, or most of the lower 48, is that, you know, it's a huge place. 9 times the size of Wisconsin, but we only have about 1/15 the population. There's only around 670,000 people here, so you know, maybe 200,000 more than in Milwaukee, not that many more. But basically, in Alaska is, I would say, on average, conservative. It's ironically anti-government, but Alaska depends on government more than any other state in the union. But that's part of the human psyche, I guess, to deny dependence. Sarah Palin got elected by a confluence of circumstances. You know, she was semi-populist. She was running against people that were old and burned out, and people wanted to change. I would say that Sarah Palin still has a lot of support here, but there are people that don't support her. But, you know, Alaska is not, should we say, as diverse as Wisconsin or Minnesota, and certainly not as liberal as those places. And I know you have conservatives in those places, too. But I think that basically, to look at Sarah Palin and think of people in Alaska thinking like her, it's not the case, but I think that there is this anti-government, anti-federal attitude in Alaska, all of which is just a myth. That, and she plays up to that, and she does a very good job of playing up to it. You know, she is semi-charismatic, she is populist, and that cuts a nice chord. I was coming down from Anchorage a couple of weeks ago on a plane, and I sat next to someone who was an ice cream salesman, a very nice guy, and he just thought that she was wonderful, and he you know, because I think she struck a chord that he found very particular. And one of the things that, of course, she tries to strike is that she's not like every other politician. And I think people hate politics, and they like politicians who run against Washington or run against the state capitol. So, of course, that in itself is subject to all sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's my take on it.
Okay. We're going to welcome more phone calls for both our guests. It's All Things Political for this Monday. We have a couple lines open. Should you care to join us, 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Professor Clive Thomas, professor of political science at the University of Alaska Southeast, and Professor Abdur Chowdhury, professor of economics at Marquette University, are our guests. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Jim Harris will be joining us. He's co-founder of We Help War Victims and co-creator of From Laos to America, Changing Worlds, Changing Times. He works with a company clearing unexploded landmines in Laos and spends a good half of the year there. His wife works with him as well, and he'll be with us to talk about the Hmong refugees who have settled in the Wausau family, their families, many of whom have been here for many years, and some are just arriving now from Laos, and the time that he is spending clearing Laos of landmines that still kill a number of people, tens of thousands of people, every year. So that's coming up the hour after you hear the news. All right, let's go back to phone calls for both our guests and to Bob from Minocqua next. Hello, Bob.
Yes. I know that you as a moderator and the two guests acknowledge the fact that most of the stimulus money went to shore up the budgets of the state governments, and that simply all that did was ensure the jobs of all of the government employees, and it also went to things like welfare. But they never, even though they acknowledged it, they never came to any kind of conclusion that there's no way that the stimulus, on the short or long, is going to solve the problem of the economy unless you stimulate the hundreds of thousands of businesses in the country. You're never going to get people back to work until the businesses become more profitable and start selling things off the shelf. Right now, all we're doing is subsidizing the state government to shore up the problems that they should have solved their own self. And that's Republicans and Democrats.
So you think more stimulus money should go directly to small businesses, Bob? What's the answer?
What I'm saying, first of all, I don't have the answer. But what I'm saying is, if the money went to all of the states to shore up their deficits, and then the money went to welfare, there's no money going towards any kind of a business to actually get to the millions of people that are out of work and the millions more that are going to continue being out of work. It didn't help sell cars. It didn't help do anything. It didn't help manufacturing. It simply went to government again and made government stronger and bigger. And then they put out, I don't know how many millions of dollars to Acorn. They do a census in the future, which only simply protects the Democratic Party's future.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Professor Chowdhury.
Yes. I do agree with the caller that, you know, the majority of the money from the stimulus has gone to state and local governments. But what that has done, it has prevented cuts in government services or tax increases that would have otherwise occurred. Now, in terms of what might happen, I think there will be some change in the summer where you will see more money going into infrastructure jobs that will start beginning to create jobs. There will be some personal tax cuts, so that will have some impact. Now, in terms of how we can help small business or medium-term business, I think one way we can help that is by trying to stimulate consumer spending. Now, what we see has happened, if you look at the numbers, that consumers are not spending. They're saving more. We have the highest savings rate in the last 15 years. So we have to stimulate consumer spending. Once that become stimulated, it will go on into, you know, helping the small business.
Professor Thomas?
Yes. Well, I'm not an expert in this area, but I tend to agree with the caller, too, to a certain extent. But remember, people who work in government also spend money. So, you know, it's sort of a multiplier effect on the economy to a certain extent. And I guess this is also a very unusual time in terms of, you know, what happened. But I think that basically, I would tend to agree with the caller to a certain extent. But I think that ultimately money in the economy, whether it's spent by state workers or businesses, is money. But I think stimulating consumer spending is important.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. And let's go to Deborah from Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Hi.
I have had an idea for a long time, and I wonder why nobody's thought about it with healthcare. And it wouldn't address all the problems, but to create something like a healthcare corps that would be run like the Peace Corps. I mean, you think of hospitals, they would have all kinds of many extra rooms for people to stay, like dorm rooms, where kids out of high school or out of college or even older folks could stay, and usually it's just bodies that are needed to clean up, to do whatever it is that needs to be done. And and also nursing homes, they also have extra rooms that something like this could happen with, and I'm wondering why something like that wouldn't work.
Professor Chowdhury, you want to take that?
Sure. What I think the caller is referring to is sort of volunteer service or Peace Corps type sort of service that can have some impact, but I think the impact would be too small to solve the problem, the complicated problem that we have in the healthcare system. So it can have some impact, but you know, I think it will be too small.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for the call. Let's go next to Bruce from West Milwaukee. Hello, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for the show. One of your guests said we need more consumer spending, the problem being that Americans are saving too much money. The problem is we need places to save money that gives good returns. And what I would propose is high-yield bonds for infrastructure like high-speed rail or light rail, which would transform our transportation system, and in the process provide jobs in electronics, in steel, in making rail cars. We need something that stabilizes the funding being spent in this country and not spent on cars from China or from some other place or from iPods from China or India. You know, the money needs to stay in this country and recirculate.
And move us
in. We don't need to do more consumer spending. We need to learn how to save and provide long-term savings yields that bring benefits back to this country. And if we had a high-speed rail system with long-term bonds that paid 10%, people would buy those bonds, they would use those rail systems, and the money would be spent here on jobs and technology and business in this country. This is crazy to tell us to
to do more consumer spending and buy iPods and cars made in Japan.
Thank you, Bruce, for your call. We'll try you again. Our phone line is a little bit, we're kind of losing you there from Alaska, Professor Thomas, but let me see if we can hear you. And you want
can you to hear me now? Okay.
Yeah, much better, much better.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I don't know what happened here.
Okay.
You want me to respond to that?
Would you please?
Okay. I guess we'd have to change the entire psyche of America. I certainly agree with the caller. I think that we need to do all sorts of things, but Americans are individualists. They're wedded to their cars. Despite what has been talked to us about for the last 30 years, we're dependent upon oil now, so we're in 1970 or pretty close. Getting Americans out their cars and on high-speed rail. I travel on the bus to work sometimes, and I have my colleagues say, why do you travel on the bus? Why don't you just drive your car? And so I think that, we could spend a whole course here talking about the American psyche, individualism, consumerism. I'm not sure you can change that overnight, but that's what it all boils down to, it seems to me. And also, you know, we tend to allow, we want to buy things cheapest. That's why Walmart is so successful, despite, you know, some of the negative things that people say about it, because it's cheap, and that's why it's successful.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that problem? I mean, you can chip away at it, but you've got to deal with fundamental psyche, and I know that's a big issue, but that would be my response.
Mm-hmm. It is the future, though, isn't it? I'm sorry, Professor Chattery.
I agree with Professor Thomas on this one, that, you know, the psyche needs to be changed, and it can't happen overnight. Here, if you compare the U.S. attitude towards public transportation compared to the European attitude towards public transportation, you can see the significant difference. And I think that explains some of the things that the caller had referred to.
Here's an email that's come in. The federal stimulus plan is all about pork and more pork. Politicians created this economic downturn by requiring subprime mortgages. And now when we need careful oversight on any money spent, they are, for the most part, in there trying to get money for their pet projects. Professor Thomas?
Partly true, I think, to a certain extent. I mean, American politics is, and particularly the federal level, is about getting money for your state. I'm not sure they caused the problem. You know, it's a multifaceted problem that's caused by many forces. I think probably most of all, you know, it was caused by just a very common human five-letter word, greed. I mean, people were doing very well, and we could look at it from this perspective, is that, you know, people complain about how they've lost money on the stock market, but, you know, 10 years ago, they had what they have now, or basically. So
mm-hmm.
In the case of, you know, today's privileges or tomorrow's demands, and I guess that's what politics gets caught up in. But there's no doubt about it that American politics is about pork, and, you know, people are going to fight for that. And it's just a neat, once again, we're back to the whole psyche of the thing. And it's not necessarily bad, but it's obviously at certain times people lose out. And in a system where people have a lot of influence and power to get that, the people that don't have it obviously lose out, the people who don't have health care.
Right. Yeah, they sure do. Let's go to Scott next from River Falls. Hi, Scott.
Great. Good morning. Health care, again, I agree with your guests. I think that's the big issue on the table and has been for years. My impression is that the fix was in when this whole debate started, because single payer was never on the table. And with the exception of Bill Moyers on Wisconsin Public Television, I don't see anybody that brings on a lot of experts that aren't either politically affiliated or paid for by lobbyists to discuss this issue. But I wanted to hear what your guests thought about the notion of where we would be if we went with a single payer plan like, say, they have in France, as opposed to the for-profit insurance industry that we've got now. And I'll get off the phone, and I
will hear
what you guys have to
say. Thanks. Professor Chattery, you want to take that? We have about 45 seconds left.
Yeah, sure. I think the reform that we are going to have would not be very close to the French model that the caller had referred to, but there will be more options available to the population in terms of which healthcare you want to refer to. So I don't see that the one that we are going to have would be very much close to the French model. I don't see that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and thanks for the call. Thank you both very much for being with us this hour. I enjoyed the discussion. Thanks. Professor Chaudhary, thank you. Professor Thomas, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on your program.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And just a reminder that we are going to continue our series of programs on healthcare reform. They are on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. We looked last week at the Canadian model. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the history of American healthcare and the proposals on the table for healthcare reform. So that's coming up tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and we welcome you to listen. Well, we invite you to listen to that discussion. Then we're going to be looking at France. Somebody brought up France just a few moments ago. We'll look at France the next week. Thanks to Professor Clive Thomas, Professor of Political Science at the University of Alaska Southeast, Professor Abdur Chaudhary, and he is a professor of economics at Marquette University, for being with us for All Things Political this Monday. Rhonda Fanning produced the program. Thanks, Rhonda. And Jalema Noel, our on-air producer here in Milwaukee, and we thank Jalema as well. We'll be with you with another hour of conversation coming up in just one moment. It's a minute now before 10 o'clock, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.